Hi there, it's Matthew Blades, and I want to tell you about my friends at Herbie Design, because we've been using them for more than 10 years for our hockey programs. But Herbie Design does team apparel faster and less expensive than most. They do embroidery, laser etching, custom awards, and really anything else you need to make your brand amazing. And I've used them to make all of my Learn From People Who Lived It thank you gifts and to create custom sweatshirts for our team moms and dads. But like I said, they're capable of so much more, and they can get it done faster and for less money than the others. Visit Herbie Design online at herbiedesign.com. And remember, they work with charter schools, dance schools, hockey programs, small businesses, large law firms, volleyball clubs, booster clubs. They can certainly work with you. When you get on the phone with Jim, let him know Matthew Blades from Learn From People Who Lived It sent you. You'll find him online at herbiedesign.com. That's H-E-R-B-I-E-Design.com. Here's a question for you. Are you a transitional character in your lineage? It's one of my favorite things to ask people these days as a motivational speaker, and I would love an opportunity to come into your business, your nonprofit, your corporation, your church, your schools, and if you've got a group of people that could really benefit from the value of a self-care strategy so they show up better for you, let's do this thing. Rates depend on the size of your group, and we can connect at learnfrompeoplewholivedit.com. My 75-minute workshop is engaging. It's interactive. It's real. It's authentic. And most importantly, as I said a moment ago, your folks will leave with a self-care strategy that will have them showing up as the best versions of themselves for you. Learnfrompeoplewholivedit.com. Click on the speaking tab.
Looking for no bullshit conversation about mental health? Find Learn From People Who Lived It wherever you get podcast. Search it using all one word. Learn From People Who Lived It.
Welcome to another episode of Learn From People Who Lived It.
I am Stuart, 53 years old.
Stuart, which story are you here to share today?
I'm here to share the story of losing my son to suicide and the shift in reality that gave me and how I worked with psychedelics to help me heal with my grief.
Who do you hope hears our conversation today?
I think there's two specific groups. I think one is any parent out there who is struggling with the loss of a child in any form, but especially suicide. And then also anybody out there struggling with mental health, suicidality, and doesn't know what to do and feels trapped by the stigmas. I hope that they will hear some things here that might possibly help. But I'm not a therapist. I'm not a psychologist, and I'm not here to tell people what they need to do. So that's not my goal. But I hope the people that are struggling in those ways will listen.
Well, you and I have something in common then. I'm very quick to let people know all the time. There's no letters after my name. I'm just somebody who went through it, and I learned a few things along the way that I think could benefit you. Well, Stuart, welcome to Learn From People Who Lived It. How are you this morning?
This morning, I'm good.
Yeah.
You know, I'm always good, and I've always got deep grief going along with me, you know, but there's always some happiness, some joy, and some sadness. It just depends on which one is boiling to the top at the moment. But right now, I'm good.
I want to say up front that I'm somebody who believes it's really dangerous to compare pain. It's really dangerous to compare your situation to somebody else's. At most, maybe we get perspective when we do that. But I would like to say up front that I believe losing a child is probably one of the worst experiences that a parent can go through. And so, having said that, let's jump right into this conversation. When you lose your son after he completes suicide, what is your life like in those moments? And we'll unravel all of this slowly, but let's jump right into that. Like, when that moment happens for you, what is going on in your heart and in your head?
Well, it's a total shift in reality. You know, there was my life now was born on the day that Ian died. It's a completely different consciousness, a completely different existence. I was on a friend's radio show, and she asked me, she said, "Hey, when did you know that your life was going to be different?" And I told her it was before the air left the vocal cords of that police officer who was giving me the bad news. Before he was even done really getting that out of his mouth, I knew I could just feel as if somebody had laid a new filter, a new film, or ripped away my old life, and everything was different. And in that moment, it's almost like I was planted here in this new life. I could speak the language, and I understood math, and I could drive a car, but it just seemed like there was a whole new reality that I was going to have to learn to deal with. And I sure shit did not want to deal with it. You know what I mean? It was something that's like, I don't want that. I was so afraid to go to bed that night because I did not want to wake up having forgotten and have to live it all over again. You know, so it was just, and it is the worst thing. I don't necessarily like comparing grief either. You know, I've made this new friend. He's a professor. He teaches a death and dying class. I recently went and spoke to his class. You know, and I said, one thing that bothers me is when I say I lost my son and somebody says, oh yeah, I get it. I lost my cat. You know, and then I'm like, dude, you know, that is not the same. And I got kind of complaining about it, but this very wise friend of mine, this professor, he was like, they don't know what to say, you know? And so the only grief that they have felt fortunately in their lives is they lost a cat that they love very much and they have a lot of pain around that. So they're doing the best they can to relate. And so I also, like you, I don't like to compare and say one thing is worse than another. But when people come to me and say, I can't imagine the pain of losing a child, I just have to agree with them. I was like, you're right, you can't. The pain is absolutely unimaginable. It's not like I watch football and I see a guy's bone come out of his leg and I'm like, oh my God, that must really hurt. And I can imagine the pain. But with this pain, it's absolutely unimaginable.
So were you close with your son, Ian?
Oh yeah. Yeah, we were very close. In fact, he was 19 when he died by suicide. And we had gotten to that point in our lives where we were becoming friends. You know, it wasn't so much me trying to, you know, I made it a point to, at least he had started his life as a software engineer at 15. And he moved out of the house when he was 17. I had to go sign for his apartment and for a car he bought. I mean, he was doing really well. And I still wanted to be there and be his dad, but we started to have lunches or breakfast. One meal a week, we would get together. And I would make it a point not to be father-like. You know what I mean? I didn't say, are you setting goals? Are you putting money aside? What are you doing with your life? You know, we just sat there and I equated to a story about elephants and how a bull elephant helps behavior of teenage elephants. And all the bull elephant does is stand there, right? I mean, he doesn't know how to parent. He just stands there. And so I try to be like the bull elephant and just be there, you know, for my kids. And so that's where we were when this happened, is we were meeting. We were good friends. He bought me tickets to Van Halen. We saw Van Halen together. We went and toured Seattle together. He got to see Microsoft and Boeing and, you know, killer whales. And so we just, we had a great relationship. He was an amazing dude.
At these breakfasts, at these lunches, were you guys talking about any of these things or feelings that he had leading up to the moment?
No, it was a total surprise. I think about 50% of suicides are complete and total surprises that people had no idea. And that's the thing. And we've all seen it in society. And sometimes, you know, I'll get irritated. You'll see like a star quarterback or a musician or somebody die. And the family will say, oh, you know, we want this to be private. We're not going to talk about it. You know, and you know, probably 75 to 90% chance the person died by suicide or drug overdose. And by not talking about it, we're continuing to put the stigma around these. And people continue to die because of it, right? But in about 50% of these cases, and that's from research and also my own anecdotal observation, people are totally surprised because you'll see these kids that are overachievers. You know, my son was one of the top software engineers in the Valley. You know, his company still, 7 years later, can't replace him. And he was a leader. He expected a lot out of people. His company would use him to help hire other software engineers, you know, people that had master's degrees from Research One universities, and none of them ever measured up to what Ian's expectations were. And so you're thinking, wow, here's this amazing kid. He's got everything. He's got his apartment, his hot rod cars, you know, this great job. And you just have no idea. He completed a came in first. I'm going to have to verify that held true, but you know, he came in first for his age category in a half marathon 3 days before he left. You know, so you look at a kid like that and you're like, wow, this kid's really got his shit together. So when it happened, it was, in fact, when this all went down, his boss called me. It was 4:04 in the afternoon on Wednesday, December 16th. And said Ian hadn't come to work. And so I drove out to Ian's apartment thinking, that he had either gotten hit by a truck because he was a belligerent bicyclist. He believed he was right. And if that meant pulling out in front of a tractor trailer, that he probably would have done that. He had a very violent dog in his neighborhood that we thought, oh my God, maybe this dog got him while he was jogging. And then our last hypothesis was diabetes. He had type 1 diabetes, where the kind of diabetes you have to give yourself insulin. And back at that time, it was shots. And if a type 1 diabetic gives themselves the wrong shot, if they give themselves a big shot of the wrong insulin, they can pass out, go into a shock, coma, even die. So we thought, I was thinking on my way out to his apartment, I kind of knew he was gone. But, you know, as a parent, when your kid is missing, your gut is like, hey, man, it's okay. He's alive. We're going to find him. And driving out to Ian's apartment, my gut was not giving me those signals. So I had this sense that something horrible had happened. And I thought that it might have been that he was having a diabetic episode and we were going to find him laying down on the floor in his apartment. I had no idea that he had decided to take his own life.
So you mentioned earlier that one of the police officers is the one that gave you the news. So my guess is that you arrived on the scene and the cops were already there.
Yeah. When I got there, the place was covered in emergency vehicles, you know, and I noticed right away that none of them were doing anything. Everybody was just standing around, so that there wasn't like they were in an emergency mode of trying to save somebody's life. And so I ended up parking right across from his apartment, and everybody's standing around. I mean, just all these people, civilians, emergency people, and, you know, I had no idea what to do. So I parked and I just kind of got out of my car and decided I was just going to walk to his apartment. And as I started walking toward his apartment, that's when the police officer came up and gave me the news.
I'm getting a little emotional, I'm not going to lie. And I don't too often get brought to tears on the podcast, but I just imagine one father to another, what that experience must have been like. And now you say before those words even left the cop's mouth, you knew your life was going to be different. And that's what I'd love to spend a little bit of time talking about is after that experience, because there's all the things you have to do. There's the funeral and, you know, there's tying up the loose ends and shutting down the apartment and getting rid of the car. You know, I mean, there's all these like these things that you have to do after somebody's left the earth. So after you complete all of the things, my guess is the realness of this moment really starts to settle in. The longevity of this moment really starts to settle in. And so I'm curious, I'm compelled to ask you, when did you start to look into psychedelics as an option for you to open up your mind and find a place of peace for this event?
Well, first of all, I'm still driving his car. So that's cool. Part, yeah, we didn't get rid of it. He had a funny license plate on it. I drive his car around. It's going to stay in our family for quite a while. I've got a great mechanic. Says he can keep the thing alive for as long as we want it. So
that's great.
Yeah, we've got a lot of things like that. We've got a lot of Ian in our lives. I don't know. It was maybe a month or two or three after Ian died. I think it was my wife fed me a blog or an article about psychedelics and how psychedelics can put somebody into a dreamlike state. And so, just, you know, quick background. I grew up in the DC area because my dad was a DEA agent. And so I grew up feeling that drugs were bad and people who did drugs were bad people. And one of the worst drugs is acid or psychedelics because they will scramble your brain and mess you up. You'll have flashbacks the rest of your life. I mean, all the lies that Nixon put out, right? And so I bought into all that, and so did my dad. And the drug war bought me a nice truck and an education. And so I came out of this whole thing with this attitude of drugs are bad. And then I got this article, and I read it, and I thought, you know, I would like to dream about Ian. You know, I'd like to have some deep dreams. I'm a pretty vivid dreamer anyway, but I thought, let's put some drugs in my brain and see what can happen with this. And so I did, and it did not help me. This way psychedelics are, right, for anybody who doesn't know, and I'm not here pushing psychedelics. They're not for everybody. I don't recommend them, and I'm not telling anybody to do them. This is just one man's story. So don't take this as my endorsement to go out and do illegal drugs. And, you know, you got to do a lot of research and take care of yourself. Don't run out there and do these things. So, but the funny thing about psychedelics, and you've had like a psychologist on the show before, right?
Plenty.
And they'll talk about this. Is a patient will come in and say, okay, doc, here's what I want to fix. Here's my intention or whatever it is. And the doc will kind of laugh in the back of his or her mind and go, yeah, sure. That's what you think you need to work on. But let's start talking, and then the real stuff will start bubbling to the top. And that's the way psychedelics are. You're like, hey, I want this. And psychedelics are like, yeah, that's fine, but I got other plans for you. I went in there hoping it would induce me to dream about Ian or to be with Ian or to connect with his soul or whatever it is. And I ended up going down the proverbial rabbit hole. And really, essentially, if I had to boil it down and make it simple, I think two things happened for me. One is it helped me find mindfulness, which is an ironic term because really it's mindlessness. And then the second thing is I think through, and again, I'm not a doctor. I'm not a neuroscientist. You know, I just read books, talk to people. It seems though psychedelics do help with neuroplasticity, which is rewiring your brain. You know, neurons that fire together wire together, which means every time you grow up looking at an apple and you learn everything around an apple is red, it's green, it's sweet, it's crunchy, it's cold, it's a computer. And so all these different things, your brain builds these models around it. And our brain has maps and models and schema around the people we love, right? Like right now, you know where your kids are roughly. And so when somebody dies, that exits out. I don't know if I can show a book, but this lady wrote this book, The Grieving Brain. A lot of great information in there about that. And psychedelics have been shown, you know, by people like Robin Carhart-Harris that do studies on this and look at MRIs, fMRIs, and you can see the neuroplasticity, the neurons getting rewired. So I think in trying to dream about Ian, I ended up putting myself into a mindful state of like meditation, and I developed a meditation practice out of it. And then I think it also helped me rewire my brain with an understanding that Ian is no longer here physically, right? So I have had to let go of my emotional attachment to Ian's physical presence. And I've had to learn to live with him in memory and in love and in spirit. So sometimes I get pretty emotional on this stuff. If you ever see me poke my cheek, it's because I'm trying not to cry. So I think that, you know, I went into it because of this article trying to maybe dream about Ian. And I ended up going down that rabbit hole and finding some real benefits from psychedelics.
I am a proponent of them, and I agree with everything that you said so far. They're not for everybody. There's certain folks who are going to take that stuff, and it's really going to wreck them. It's really going to put them in a bad place. And there's other people who, like, wow, it just completely unlocks them. In our podcast, Reserve for Vets, we have a guy named Chad who's a former Army Ranger who had really bad PTSD, and ketamine has been his unlock tool. Mm-hmm. He's about 9 or 10 treatments into ketamine, and he is literally a night and day human being. And so I know that those stories are out there. Obviously, you're sharing your story. Was there something that, and do you mind actually telling me what psychedelics you opted in for?
All of them. I started off with mushrooms, and I did a lot of research, set and setting, dose, substance, and I liked the naturalness of the mushrooms and working with magic mushrooms. So I started with that. I had a very, very nice journey where I learned that all humans are connected, that love is all you need. I cried, but not like a deep, sobbing, grieving cry. It was just more like a, oh, wow, this is what everybody's talking about. This is it. I had access to the beautiful nature of our souls and our greater consciousness. And I can't believe I'm saying that. I grew up a hardcore scientist, atheist. So for me to say these kind of things, it still baffles me that I'm thinking and saying these things. But yeah, I've worked with mushrooms mostly. I've worked with a little bit with LSD. Quite a few times with ayahuasca, peyote several times. Peyote turned me into a vegetarian. San Pedro and DMT and 5-MeO DMT. So it's that's over a long period. So I can sit here and rattle these off, and I sound like a druggie, like somebody who's using these substances to escape. You know what I mean? You're like, oh, you're trying to get away from your feelings and all this, and you know I'm probably go on a journey every 2 or 3 months, you know, so it's not a matter of, okay, that felt good, let's do it again tomorrow. You know, and the good thing about a lot of these drugs, if I do mushrooms today, I really can't do them tomorrow. I mean, I can double the dose and I can do it again, right? But they are like counter addictive or whatever it is. So they're, if you do it right now, I can't do it again later because my brain has already gotten the serotonin adjustments and it's just not going to work. Also, you, no offense, but you kind of feel like crap. You know what I mean? When you get done with a mushroom journey or whatever, I mean, ayahuasca, you're throwing up, right? So ayahuasca, you're like, bleh. And even though that's a purge and it's really emotionally and psychologically freeing, it's still barfing. You know what I mean? So it's still like, it's not the greatest thing in the world. People fight it. You can see them writhing around trying not to throw up. And you're just like, man, just throw up. Cause that's what you're here for. But we don't like to throw up, you know, and you don't like the nausea that comes with mushrooms. And sometimes I get headaches and you feel drained. And it's like if your psychotherapist was also a boxer. And as he took you through your therapy, it was also slugging you in the gut and in the face. You know, when you got done, you were kind of like, wow, that was really good, but I'm feeling really worn out and beat up. So it's not something like ecstasy or, you know, whatever. You take it and you're like, man, that was great. Or meth or whatever. You feel like, okay, that was great. I need to have it again. For most of us, when we're done with it, we're like, crud, I need a break. I need to integrate what I learned. I need to sit with this for a while. And I certainly don't want to feel this bad again.
Was there a moment in one of your journeys where you found some peace with Ian?
No, not directly. So it all helped me indirectly, but there were a couple instances related to Ian. One is I feel like his soul was coming to me and it scared me.
I was going to say it had to be so emotional.
Yeah, but it scared me. And I think when I got scared, it started to retreat. So I didn't get to have the full connection with that. And in my podcast, my consciousness podcast, I interviewed a guy named Pim Van Lommel, and he's like one of the experts in near-death experiences. And one of the things he kind of explained is, you know, there can be connections. It seems observing. He's not promising or making any kind of declaration, but there can be connections to loved ones who have died once you're ready for it. Because otherwise it can kind of screw you up, right? If this powerful soul comes to you and connects with you, it can like scramble you up and be a problem. So I guess that they wait until you're ready. So maybe I wasn't ready. I don't really know what it was. So that was the first time where I felt this presence coming toward me. And then another time in the middle of an ayahuasca ceremony, I kind of took on, and it's very, very gruesome, but I took on Ian's death as it was happening to him. And my body started to die as Ian died. And it was very gruesome and traumatic, but at the same time, it felt very real and very maybe freeing a little bit. And it's kind of like taking medicine or learning something in school you don't care about. You know, you're kind of like, okay, I'm glad that I went through that, but I didn't come out of it like elated or like some great big important thing happened. I just came through it like, oh my God, that was important. And it was really awful. So there's been a couple connections here and there with Ian, but I think the biggest thing that the psychedelics have helped me with is to get me centered and to get me back on track in life, to help me go with my flow, to find my flow. So not so much about, oh, I need to find myself, because I think I already am myself. I just need to find my path, right? I need to get dialed into my flow and into my path. And through mindfulness and through meditation and through where the psychedelics, what they've exposed me to in terms of consciousness and awareness, I think that they've really helped me find my flow. And through finding my flow, I've been able to find peace, and I've been able to find freedom, which freedom from my mind, freedom from desire, freedom from being attached to Ian's physical presence because it's not here anymore. That has allowed me to find joy in life and some other things in life, you know, and it's again, you know, I'm not saying everybody out there, go take a bag of mushrooms and you're going to, you know, I lost 60 pounds, you know, I wrote a couple books, two of which are published, one of which nobody besides my daughter will ever see. And started a new business. You know, it's just little things started happening, I think, because I found my flow. And life is not perfect. I still lose my temper. I still get mad. I still drop into deep wells of grief. It just helped me dial in to whatever that is. You know, Taoists call it the Tao. You know, I don't know what Christians would call it, but there's like some power out there, you know, that if you can tap into it and dial into it and ride it like a wave, that things just start kind of lining up. And I think that's what it did for me more than anything.
I felt like, I've tried a few things too. And I always tell people that, at least for me, whereas I used to be an alcoholic. And so when I would drink, I would try to like escape from things. I would, you know, knowing what I know now, I was trying to forget and escape from those things. But with psychedelics, I felt like I was running towards something. I felt like I was truly opting into an experience where I was trying to get better. And I don't know, does that resonate with you?
Yeah. Because I don't know that you really, I don't know that one really has a choice in that matter, because you're playing with your brain and your soul, and you're using these substances, most of which are just grown out of the ground, and it helps you tap into, you know, and some people like to bring up Jung, Carl Jung, and your shadow and archetypes, but I don't know if I believe all that, but it certainly does help you tap into inside depth. You know what I mean? And so that is a different experience as opposed to opening you up and going out and dancing and whatever. Not that those are bad. Those are wonderful. But this is just a different experience that I think it does help you tap into that inner you.
When do you know, Stuart, that you are ready for another journey?
It sounds so hooey woo woo, but they start calling me.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And it's kind of like, you know, if your mom made a certain dish you grew up with, you know, spaghetti or lasagna or cacciatore or whatever, all Italian stuff. I don't even like Italian food. But if your mom made something and then, you know, you haven't had it in years or whatever, you start smelling it, you know, and you start tasting it and you're like, dude, I got to have my mom's spaghetti and meatballs. And so I'm not Italian, I'm Scottish, but Scottish, they don't have good food. So my mom made
Italian. It's very bland. It's very bland. Yes.
Very bland. And so, but it's like that, right? Every now and then I will just start to remember smell, remember experience an ayahuasca ceremony. And I'll be like, okay, it's time. It's time for me to go do that. Same thing with mushrooms. Mushrooms, I don't love the taste of them, but I will still find myself craving them. I'll still get to a point where I'm like, I'm going to try, you know, it's ready for me to do this again. Or it might be a psychological cue where I can feel myself struggling with something. And it's not like, so there's this, I think a lot of the psychedelics get a bad rap because of the Silicon Valley dorks that they're like, oh, I need my business to be better, so I'm going to go eat a bag of mushrooms, right? Or I'm going to microdose mushrooms. And that's not how I approach it. So, but for me, I can feel like, oh, I'm ready for some insight, you know? And I do the meditation and I study Ram Dass and I read books and I read from the Tao Te Ching every day. And so I'm constantly kind of on my path. And so I think sometimes in my subconscious, unconscious, whatever anybody wants to call it, is sometimes it's like, hey, there's something hanging around in here we need to kind of dig out. And then I'll start feeling like, okay, it's time for me to go do it. Because even right now, it's been months, you know, since my last journey. So it's not something that I'm like, gotta do it. But there are times when it comes up and I'm like, yeah, I'm ready and I'm craving it. There's, you know, I'm getting some signals and then you go.
Our podcast is called Learn From People Who Lived It. And you have a couple of podcasts out there that you've worked on, the Consciousness Podcast and the Stoned Ape Theory. Or the Stoned Ape podcast. What have you learned from doing those? Is there a couple of major takeaways in all the interviews that you executed?
Oh, yeah. So the consciousness one, nobody knows anything, right? I mean, there's a lot of really smart experts, and none of them know for sure because, like Dr. Chalmers says, it's the hard problem of consciousness. Nobody has answered the hard problem of consciousness, which is why do we have a phenomenal experience of life? But I came out of that thinking we've got different levels of consciousness. We have the sensual level, which is our body. We have the mind-ego level, which is our mind and our cognitive experience of life. And then we've got the higher level, which you could call awareness. You could call it your soul, where you're able to get into a mind space where you actually observe your own thoughts and you observe your actions and you're observing your own existence. I think very few people are ever in that without intentionally working on that. It's very difficult. And then when it happens, you're kind of like, well, that wasn't difficult. But it turns out it was really difficult, at least for me. Maybe some people just sit down and cross their legs and bam, they're there. But for me, it took months and years of meditating. And finally, in New Mexico at a retreat, I was like, boom, I got into it, and my whole 9-hour drive home, I was like, oh my God, I'm still in this state. So I learned these different levels. I also believe consciousness is basically the brain creating models, schema, maps with neurons. But I think that there's also potential for your brain to be some kind of a radio antenna that taps into a greater consciousness. And that's where the other side of it, the stoned ape reports on, and the psychedelic side of it. When I took a very deep trip with 5-MeO-DMT, which can come from toads, but please don't bother the toads. Leave the toads alone. Find a synthetic version if you decide to do this. Don't mess with these wonderful creatures. On this experience, I ended up out there. I left my body and I was out there with this greater consciousness, and I was with all the souls that ever existed. We're all up there, right? You were there. All of us were there. And I ended up looking down at Earth and like, oh, heck, we created this thing so we could play in it. It's like a great big playground that we all created for ourselves. And Hindus believe we go back over and over and over again until we finally get it right. I think it's just fun. I think we've got a unique opportunity to be here on Earth and enjoy the sensual level, to eat a slice of pizza and to make love and all these, you know, stand on a mountain, and the cognitive side, to look at art and to read books and have deep conversations like we're having now. And then the higher level consciousness is really to be the observer and have this and really truly experience all this from the observer's point of view. So that's the consciousness side. I may or may not be right about any of it. I really don't know. But after talking to everybody, that's where I've landed. And then the fun thing on the Stoned Ape Reports side of it is I talked to maybe 50 people, you know, and some good ones. I mean, they're all good. They're all great. You know, some people are really impressed that Dennis McKenna came on the show, you know, or that I interviewed the guys from the Shock and Awe, you know, about the soldiers and PTSD and ketamine. And, you know, so I got lucky and, you know, some big names came on, which on the consciousness podcast, I enjoyed. On the Stoned Ape Reports, I really prefer to talk to other stoned apes, people who were struggling in life with something and came into psychedelics and just shared their story. And their stories are all basically, here's what was I was dealing with in my life. Here's the experience I had with psychedelics, and here's how my life is different. And hearing their stories, it could be anything from addiction. One guy, one hit of acid was done with alcohol. You know, he had an alcohol problem, never drank again. And the founder of Alcoholics Anonymous actually wanted to use LSD. He was a Mormon, right? And he wanted to use LSD to treat people and help get them off of alcohol. And so complex PTSD, anxiety, depression. And what I started to discover as a layperson is that behind almost all of this is trauma. And so as they would talk to me and they would say, yeah, I had this problem, and we keep talking, and then the trauma would come out, and they would say, yeah, this happened to me, or that happened to me. You know, my buddy got blown up, or I got hurt by my uncle, or, you know, whatever it was, molested, assaulted. I should not code it. You know, these things happened, and they turn to behaviors to numb it, you know, because they didn't know what else to do. And so they're abusing substances and alcohol and sex and gambling and whatever. I interviewed one person who struggled with bulimia for 30 years, 20, 30 years. Wow. Wow. And she went on an iboga experience down in Mexico. Iboga is a bark that comes from Africa. The African Bwiti tribe use it as a rite of passage. So if you've ever seen in movies or whatever where an African tribe, you know, drinks this concoction or whatever, and they go out into the psychedelic space and they see their ancestors and they deal with all this stuff, that's iboga. And she did iboga, and it stopped her bulimia. But in the conversation, she was late. She was like maybe number 50 or 49 or something in my list of people. I won't say I was exasperated or tired of it, but I just knew. I was like, okay, there's trauma. She hasn't told me about any trauma. And so I just said, what was the trauma? And then she just flat out said, you know, that a relative had been, and trigger warning anybody, that a relative had been orally raping her as a kid. So I'm about to lose it myself because I feel so bad for her. Yeah. And she turned to an oral disorder. And iboga helped her really uncover all that, really helped her. And now she's working with other people, which happens a lot in this community. You know, we get all this amazing help from these fungi and these plants and these chemicals. And we're like, wow, holy shit, this was great. We need to go tell other people. And so she's actually doing this, you know, for a living now, helping other people. But that was a big thing. is almost every single one of them had this amazing story of I had this problem and then I took these substances and now I don't have the problem anymore. But really underneath the problem was some major trauma. And I think that that's really where the psychedelics helped, was to help them process that trauma.
I'm nervous to ask you this next question a little bit, but maybe I'm going to assume that you have thought about it at some point. Do you believe that Ian would have benefited from psychedelics?
Yeah, totally. Who knows, right? I mean, so when you lose a child or maybe anybody, but I think especially when you lose a child, your life becomes filled with what ifs, right? What if I had done this? What if I had said this? What if? And so, yeah, I think to myself, you know, what if, you know, what if just by chance somebody had given him a bag of mushrooms, you know, and he had eaten those? And because there was a study recently done that showed that one dose of psilocybin, which is what's in magic mushrooms, is as effective as pharmaceutical antidepressants, as a regimen of antidepressants. One dose of magic mushrooms is as effective. Now, the truth is the pharmaceuticals aren't that effective. You have to kind of go through a whole bunch of them before you find the one that actually works for you. But like comedian Gary Goldman says, you know, people like to bag on pharmaceuticals, but he says, you know, I'd rather, you know, shit my pants at a bus stop than be dead. And I'm like, yeah, exactly. So stop bagging on pharmaceuticals because they're saving people's lives. Sure. But I sometimes think to myself, I didn't know Ian was depressed. I didn't know he was struggling. And so I feel like, yeah, maybe if he had tried some of these, maybe it would have opened something up or done something. But at the time, remember, Matthew, I was anti-drug and thought drugs were bad and all that. So I was not likely to come to him and say, hey, try this.
As you cycle now through your adult life without Ian, one of the things that I like to ask parents who have lost children is, what did he teach you?
So what did he teach me as a human being, as my son, while he was alive?
And then what have you learned from him since he's been gone?
You know, it's an interesting question because I think a lot of stuff I've learned since he died, because I hear from so many people about all, so many people came out of the woodworks that I had no idea he had affected so many people. You know, I mean, his ceremony had maybe 100, 200 people at it. Wow. And I didn't invite all of them. And they all came. It was a packed room. We got a church, a Universalist Unitarian church or whatever, and filled that whole freaking space. I bet the minister was jealous. All these people have come out and told me things about Ian, you know, and they just mentioned his very high standards, that he held everybody to a very high standard, that I knew he had a very biting sense of humor. So he would really let you have it. I mean, one of our senators, Matt Salmon, came and talked to their group and sat with Ian, and that was probably his biggest mistake he made that day, because Ian was going to tell him the truth about him and tell it. Basically, I think told the guy he didn't have time to talk to him, you know, and the guy did not like to hear that. So he was funny. He was creative. He had a huge heart. But I think all of the lessons he taught me, ironically, were more parenting stuff. And I really have to credit his mom with most of the stuff that I actually learned, because Ian was, I don't want to label somebody, but he was kind of difficult. You know, he wanted things the way he wanted things, even as a little tiny guy. And so he wanted things the way he wanted things. And if we didn't have it like that, he might throw a fit. And some of it was funny. You know, I look at family vacation videos and there he is acting like a turd. And I just started laughing. He and I had a really important conversation. And so I think that a lesson I hope I taught him actually came back to me because I needed to learn it. And it's not a big, important lesson. It's just, he called me and said, hey, I'm thinking about leaving this one job for another one. Because where he was, I just want to be careful, I don't insult anybody here, but they didn't have the level of code standards that he expected. And he got recruited by another company that had that, that was led by a guy who'd been turning Google down over and over and over again because he wanted to be part of this company and ended up being Ian's mentor. And so he made an important decision, and he called me that day and he said, hey, you know, I'm struggling with this, you know, that's, you know, and I told him, I said, you know, I spent 4 years, and sorry, everybody who's a veteran, I spent 4 years in the Army watching people accept and push and reward poor standards. And it just became a system of mediocrity. And I got sucked into this mediocrity. And I was a Patriot missile officer. You know, we were a combat arms group, just like field artillery or artillery and the grunts. But it was just mediocre. Nobody seemed to actually care and actually have standards. And so I told him, I said, yeah, if you're not careful, you're going to get sucked into mediocrity. you're going to start thinking that is the standard, that that's okay. And so he ended up going to the new company and maintaining a very high level of expectations and standards. And I think that during his life and then here at the, you know, post-physical Ian, that's something that I've learned to carry with me, and I'm not a badass like him, right? I mean, he would literally stand up to anybody anytime and tell them how they're not meeting the standards. I don't know that I have quite his level of confidence and courage, but I do find myself almost in his honor trying to maintain a higher level of standards, you know, around me. And having that, the courage to do that, I think it came from Ian and the way he was able to really hold people to a standard all around him.
One of the things I'm thinking about as I talk to you is, you know, when my father died back when we were 23, you know, what you have is this whole group of people. They're all hurting. They're all lost. They're all looking for answers. And I don't know that you've ever settled in, but how long do you feel like it kind of took you and your family members to want to go out to a restaurant again or to want to go out for bowling night? You know, and I'm just making things up. You can insert your own activity there. But was it a while before you were ready to sort of, what's the word, get back to versions of the past?
Yeah, I don't know. You know, my wife at the time, his mom, and I started, we had always been going out to our favorite restaurant here in Gilbert, Arizona. It's gone now. But as a family, we would go there. And then my wife and I would go there. And then when Ian died, we took some time off. I don't think it was a huge amount of time, but it was a kind of place where we knew all the staff, right? That when one of the staff members would leave, we would give them a going away present. And there were hugs, and you know what I mean? They would make me off menu stuff because I'm a vegetarian. And so there's things that they would do. They were like a family, like an extended family. So we disappeared for a couple months, and they all heard through the grapevine, and they knew what was happening. And it was a very emotional time for she and I to go back in there, to even just walk into the place and sit down. And it was very somber. You know what I mean? The whole place was like, oh my gosh, they're back. You know, and here they are, and they were, it's hard. It's very hard to be a loved one of somebody who's going through this because you don't know what to do. You don't know what to say. You don't know how to behave. And so they did a pretty good job of just being there for us and not feeling like they had to do anything. So we started slowly with that, but you know, as a family, we're not really exciting. We're not bowling people. We would, you know, still go on little hikes out to the, you know, Rio Salado and hope to catch the horses out there and do little things. Most of it, I think we carried Ian with us to honor him and to be with him as we did it. So I don't know how long it took us. That's the thing, is the first year or two are like a wet oil painting that somebody comes along with a paint roller and just rolls over it and mushes it all. It's hard to remember exactly what was going on and how we were behaving and when things went from one phase to another back in that time. But, and still it's been 7 years. It'll be, you know, I don't know when this will get released, but it'll be 7 years on December 16th this year. Yeah. Things are not normal. And I know you're not asking me that. Things are not normal. Things have not returned to any level of normalcy. That whole normal life was burned to the ground, and it's not to be returned to again. You know, it's just a different existence right now. And I don't know when we were able to really do one thing together.
Will you do something special on the 16th?
Yeah, I take the whole day to be with Ian. So I light one of those little Jewish candles. I always call it a Yahtzee candle. I'm not really sure exactly. I think it's Yahtzee or I don't know what it is. But I bought a whole pack of them because they light for an entire day, right? So the Jewish people, they at the anniversary of a death like that, they will light this candle. And so I was like, well, that's pretty smart. And so I got these candles. We have a shrine in Ian's room and a permanent shrine in there. And I will take whatever touches my heart at the moment. I'll take 3 or 4 or 5 things from that. I'll take it down into the family room. And I'll put it on a little table, and I'll light my little Yahtzee candle, and I'll play old videos of him. I still 7 years later find it very hard to hear his voice as an adult. Right, most of the videos are as a kid, a little kid, where he's just cute and fun and pain in the ass. But as an adult, it's hard to hear his voice. But he had a couple podcasts. He used to teach classes, you know, impromptu classes, not like as a professor, but he would teach something about Linux or I don't know what. Those can be difficult, but I'll try to play a little bit of that. I'll look at my wife created a bunch of albums of olden day photos, you know, like, and so I'll flip through those and I'll look at those photos and then I'll play Metallica and Megadeth. I don't even like Megadeth, right? And I'll play Metallica and Megadeth. And then I go have lunch at Ted's Hot Dogs, which, you know, anybody else on the planet, unless you're from Buffalo, you probably don't know Ted's Hot Dogs, but it's like the best hot dogs on the planet. And he and I used to go there all the time and he would get a foot long. In fact, after he died, we had a big event where we bought everybody a foot long. I called Ted's and said, we're going to buy foot longs. And so we stood there for like an hour and everybody that came through and got a foot long, we gave them, you know, we just gave them a ticket, said, if you're getting a foot long, give them this and we'll pay for it. But I will go there. I'll go there to that day, December 16th, and I'll have a veggie dog. But I'll go there and I'll have a veggie dog and some fries in a boysenberry. Is that what it is? A boysenberry drink. And just sit there and have a moment with Ian.
For anybody, as we kind of come to a close here, who is on this podcast because they've just experienced the worst day of their life and lost a child to suicide, what words of comfort might you offer them?
Man, there is no comfort. There is no words of comfort. You're going to hear over and over and over again that it doesn't get better, and that's just not true. It does get better. You do start to heal. The wells of grief, the deep wells of grief, or you might look at it as a spike in grief, however you want to look at it. But those moments are as deep as ever. And that's why I think some people say it doesn't get better, because I will get stricken with grief and it'll be just as bad and I'll be in tears. I can end up in tears over things that don't really are even directly related 7 years later. So people say it doesn't get better, but what happens is those things become further between episodes and you get more used to things. We call them landmines, right? So if I see a skinny kid with a snapback hat in a book bag or something, sometimes it reminds me of Ian. You know, in the early days, it would drop me into deep grief. Today, I look at it and it's almost a pleasant thing. It's almost, I have a memory of Ian. I think about Ian. So there's nothing I can say to you. You're going through the worst of the worst of the worst. And you just got to take one day at a time. And so, it's the worst, but it will start to get better. And if you have other kids, just be there for them, love them, and give them hope. Hope is what's missing, you know, with kids that die by suicide. So give your kids hope. Let them know that there's hope. Talk about it. Talk about when you're ready, not right now, but get out there and talk about suicide. Use the word suicide. Say died by suicide. Talk about mental health and depression and anxiety and bullying or whatever it is that, you know, that led to this. Because if we talk about it, then we'll start to break the stigmas. And if we break the stigmas, then people will get help. And if they get help, then maybe they won't die.
Stuart, I can't thank you enough for coming on and sharing your story with us today. And I feel very strongly about the thing that I'm getting ready to say next, which is I feel in these moments like I get to meet Ian. As I'm talking to you, I get a strong sense about who he was. I have a visual of Ian. I never met him before. I've never even seen a photo of him before, but I have this image in my head of who this young man was and what he was all about. And so thank you for coming on and sharing enough for all of us, hopefully, to put that image into our head. And then I want to echo what you said, which is, can we please all keep talking about it? Can we please help reduce the stigma surrounding mental health? And you'd be amazed at one little conversation and how much that might let the air out of tires enough for somebody to just go another day. Mm-hmm. And I just know, because I've seen it myself, as you have, how much power there is in helping people feel less alone, encouraging them to talk about it themselves. There's a ton of healing power in that. And so I have to believe that a lot of people have come away from our podcast today feeling that sense like, okay, you're right. I got to talk about this. I got to do something about it. And you mentioned earlier that you've written a couple of books, one that we'll never see. But what were your books about, Stuart?
Well, one of them is called The Grief Trip. It's about this whole thing. It's so short, you can read it by accident. And I offer it, you know, you can buy it on Amazon off my website, but I also offer it for free as a PDF download. So if there's any parents out there that, because it helps all of us to read somebody else's story. You know what I mean? We've been through this, and they've all had somebody deliver the bad news, or they found their loved ones on their own, or, you know, whatever it is. And we all have our own unique story, but we all share so much. So if anybody out there wants to read it, they can. I talk about the psychedelics. So that's out there. If you want to get to know Ian, completebadass.com. You know, it's we had to fight the Secretary of State here to get that. We have the Complete Badass Foundation, where we raise money to help people get ketamine treatments, like you said, because ketamine is a great way to break somebody out of very deep, dangerous suicidality. So when somebody is in that spot where things are very dire, getting them to a ketamine clinic, and sometimes a ketamine clinic will get them to another center to get some help first, and then they'll work on the ketamine. But getting into that help, that's what it's all about. But you can read about Ian, you can read my eulogy, you can see photos of him. And then, yeah, there's that book, The Grief Trip, which is just basically a book version of my show, The Stoned Ape Show.
We have three goals with Learn From People Who Lived It. One, to help you feel less alone. Two, encourage you to seek out a coach, a therapist, a church, anyone who can help you get through your journey and find some healing. Three, when you're ready, share your story with us.
Find Learn From People Who Lived It wherever you get podcast. Search it using all one word, Learn From People Who Lived It.
Here's a question for you. Are you a transitional character in your lineage? It's one of my favorite things to ask people these days as a motivational speaker, and I would love an opportunity to come into your business, your nonprofit, your corporation, your church, your schools, and if you've got a group of people that could really benefit from the value of a self-care strategy so they show up better for you, let's do this thing. Rates depend on the size of your group, and we can connect at learnfrompeoplewholivedit.com. My 75-minute workshop is engaging. It's interactive. It's real. It's authentic. And most importantly, as I said a moment ago, your folks will leave with a self-care strategy that will have them showing up as the best versions of themselves for you. Learn From People Who Lived It.com. Click on the speaking tab.